Chapter 12 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Cerro de Pasco. I want to give you some pictures of Cerro de Pasco, the highest mining town of the world. It is situated here on the top of the Andes, on the very roof of South America, at an altitude of 14,200 feet above the sea. It is 3,000 or 4,000 feet above Leadville and almost twice as high as Mexico City. It is more than 1,200 miles south of the Panama Canal and something like 3,000 miles from the Strait of Magellan. I came here from Oroya over the line built by the Cerro de Pasco Copper Corporation, which owns the great mines. The rails are made of American steel and the ties are of Oregon pine. The track is as smooth as that of the New York Central from Buffalo to Albany, and the comfortable cars were built in the United States. The bridges came from the American Bridge Company at Pittsburgh, and the locomotives are Baldwin's or Rogers. The engineers and the conductors on the road are Americans, but the firemen and the laborers are Indians and Cholos, that is, people of mixed Spanish and Quechua blood. I am told that the road paid for itself within the first 2 years after building, and that its traffic steadily grows. Cerro de Pasco lies in a valley between two mighty ranges of snow-capped mountains rich in minerals. It is just about as far south of the equator as Panama is north of it, but at this altitude of almost 3 miles, the climate is like that of southern Canada. There are frequent snowstorms in the winter, when at night the thermometer goes down almost to zero. In the summer, it rains in the afternoons, but the mornings are clear, and for about 6 months of the year, the sun shines all the day through. The town has about 15,000 Cholo and Indian inhabitants, most of whom live in one-story houses made of plastered adobe, and a small number of whites. The buildings are in blocks, walling the streets, and are painted in bright colors. One house may be a brilliant green, the next blue, and the next red or golden yellow or white. As I walked through the town, I observed that the woodwork was freshly painted, and that the American mining official who was with me told me that the law requires that the street front of every house must be painted once every 2 years. If it is not, the owner is fined. He said that the painting time had just passed, and therefore the city looked fresh. The houses have roofs of tile or galvanized iron that extend out over the sidewalks. There are no eaves troughs, and when it rains, the water usually pours off the roofs down the back of one's neck. The sidewalks are narrow, and the principal roadways are paved with cobbles, with a gutter of slabs about 10 inches wide and 6 inches deep running through the middle of the street. The streets all slope to the center, and the sewage runs off through this gutter. The most important buildings of Cerro de Pasco face upon a plaza. As I went through it, I saw about 150 llamas resting on the stones. Each animal had a package of ore strapped to his back. As I looked, some of the llamas got up. They rest much as camels do, putting their knees under them and lying flat on their bellies. Many of them were chewing their cuds, and I could see their jaws moving back and forth, showing their teeth. Some of the llamas were white, others brown, and some were spotted like a calico pony with black, brown, yellow, and white. These beasts of burden are as observing as a fox terrier and continually turn their heads this way and that for every new thing in sight. Their wool looks like that of the Angora goat, but is coarser. It is used chiefly by the natives and is not exported. Strolling up the main street, I pass the principal stores, which are filled with goods from Europe and the United States. I saw canned fruits from California, salmon from Oregon, cotton cloths from Massachusetts, and sewing machines of well-known American makes. There were also many articles of native manufacture, such as ponchos made from the hair of llamas and sheep, rude sandals used by the Indians, and shoes so clumsy that they could not have come from Massachusetts. Over some of the doors, I noticed tassels and fringes of tissue paper, which I was told were the signs of saloons selling chica, the native drink. The crowds in the streets were typical of Highland Peru. There were Peruvians of the upper classes dressed as we are, scores of cholos, and Indian men and women who had driven their llamas in from the country loaded with vegetables and other native merchandise. There were many cargadores, or porters, with great loads on their backs, and Indian women and girls wearing huge hats on their heads, shawls around their shoulders, and voluminous skirts. I am told that neither the chola nor the Indian woman ever changes her skirt. She puts one on and keeps it there until it is worn out. As each grows thinner, she adds another, till at last she reaches enormous dimensions. She wears her shawl and hat indoors and out, and it is difficult to persuade a servant girl to remove either while at her work. The Indian men and boys wear coarse suits of clothes that are made in the same sizes for children and grown-ups. They have ponchos and hats, but no shoes. Some wear sandals, but many are barefooted. The streets swarm with children, and nearly every woman and girl has a child tied to her back. Sometimes the baby is on the outside of a burden, and it bobs up and down as the mother carries the heavy load over the road. She bends half double as she goes along at a sort of dog trot. Few of the women are handsome, and they all look dirty and rather repulsive. They start carrying burdens while they are children, and I see girls no taller than my waist with babies strapped to their backs. The men carry enormous weights uphill and down. Their chief strength is in their backs, and they have to get under a load to carry it. At one place, I saw eight of them moving a piano. They did not raise it with their hands, but tied ropes to its legs, and then pulled on the ropes over their shoulders until they were able to lift the instrument to their backs. After that, they trotted on up the hill. The foreign colony of Cerro de Pasco is quite as interesting as the native. Here, more than 3,000 miles south of the United States and almost 3 miles above the sea, is an American industrial center. I call it American because it is run by American money, but in fact, the salaried employees come from all over the world. There are English, Australians, Germans, Austrians, Irish, and Danes. There are graduates of Massachusetts Tech, of McGill in Canada, and of the leading universities of Europe. In short, the experts of a half dozen different nations. Many of them have their families with them, and I have yet to meet a man or a woman who is not pleased with the conditions here. The Cerro de Pasco Copper Corporation does everything it can to make life agreeable, and the people live almost as well as at home. Hotels with bathrooms and all modern conveniences have been put up for the bachelors. The married employees have comfortable stone cottages and can buy many of their supplies at the company store. There are clubhouses with libraries and reading rooms supplied with the latest magazines and papers, and also bowling alleys, billiard tables, and rooms for entertainments and dances. There are tennis courts and baseball grounds where the smelter employees sometimes play a game with a team from the mines. However, the air is so thin that baseball is indulged in only moderately, and tennis, for newcomers at least, is always played in doubles. The foreign colony publishes a creditable monthly magazine, the Inca Chronicle, which has the distinction of being printed nearer heaven than any other periodical on earth. There is a hospital here with expert physicians and trained nurses, and when the men are sick, they are well cared for or are sent down the hill. The terms down the hill and up the hill are used here in referring to the journey to or from the seacoast. Most of the Americans and other foreigners, men, women, and children, seem in good health. There are, however, some who cannot stand the thinness of the air at this altitude, and many are afflicted with pneumonia and have to be sent back post-haste on special trains. I know of employees who have come up 3 or 4 different times and, going down sick each time, have at last had to give up and return to the States. On the other hand, I have just been told of one Englishman who had lived at this high altitude continuously for 23 years. At the end of that time, he won a lottery prize of $5,000, took a long leave of absence, and went down to Lima, intending to live in grand style as long as his funds lasted. He had been so many years in a rarefied atmosphere, however, that he could not stand the low altitude of the capital, and was obliged to return to Cerro de Pasco before he had time to get well started on spending his money. The sorosha, or mountain sickness, seems to attack everyone here when he first reaches an altitude of 2 miles or more above the sea. Every foreigner I have met has been more or less afflicted with it, although with some it merely means a slight difficulty in breathing. As a rule, most people recover from it quickly, although it returns at any overexertion or imprudence. The first symptoms of the illness are nausea and pains in the head. Then comes vertigo and dimness of sight and hearing. Fainting fits may follow, and the blood may flow from one's eyes, nose, and lips. Those who have weak lungs are liable to have hemorrhages, and people with weak hearts become unconscious. Sorosha sometimes even causes death. I had an attack of sorosha during my first trip to South America. As I came here yesterday over the Central Railway, I could feel the air growing rarer. At 10,000 feet, my breath was so short I could not whistle, and much of my dictation at 15,000 feet was done in a whisper. After we passed the 2 mile level, I found myself weighing each sentence to see whether it was worth the effort required to utter it. At the stations, I walked very slowly, and when the train started unexpectedly at Casapalca and I had to run to get on, I panted for 5 minutes before I recovered. The blood pounded in my ears, and the top of my head felt as though it were being pried up with a crowbar. In the cars behind me were men and women holding smelling bottles at their noses, and one Peruvian had a bottle at his nose and a gun in his bag. Before I came out of the train, he told me he had two cures for the sorosha. One is the smelling bottle, he said, and asked me to try it. But will it do the business, said I? I don't know, he replied, but if not, I have a sure cure here, and he opened his bag and showed me the revolver. The sorosha attacks different individuals in different ways. My secretary had a slight touch of it, but this soon passed off, and he thought he was proof against further trouble. He walked 6 miles that day, and then spent an hour in the bowling alleys at the club. At the same time, he ate with his usual zest, and the result is that he has now a well-developed case of sorosha. He is the color of cheese, he cannot take 3 steps without resting, and he loathes all manners of meat. A man who came up on the train with me says that his head began to ache during the night, and his pulse jumped to 120. A young mining engineer who came last week to the Morococha copper property was met at the depot with horses and rode at a gallop to the mines. This brought on such a severe attack that he was obliged to go back to Lima and spend a while on the coast. When he comes up again, he will stop at Matucana, which has an altitude of 8,000 feet, and then make the remainder of the journey by easy stages. I have talked with the doctors here as to the cause of sorosha. They say it comes from the thinness of the air. One system is accustomed to a certain percentage of oxygen with each breath he takes. You breathe at the same rate here as at the coast, but you get less oxygen, and as a result your blood becomes impure, and there is a loading up of waste matter throughout the body, causing auto-intoxication, and if it continues long enough, you have sorosha. The atmospheric pressure here is much less than at the seacoast. At Lima, it is about 15 pounds to the square inch, and here it is less than 9 pounds. Consequently, it takes 6 minutes to soft boil an egg, and you may boil beans all day and not have them cooked all through. For in this atmosphere, water passes off into vapor at a lower temperature than it does near sea level. Many of the wiseacres, when they first come to the mountains, disregard what the doctors say. They do not take the ordinary precautions, and the result is usually a serious case of sorosha or even pneumonia. The other day, a visiting physician was told he must not go out without his coat. He replied that his business was medicine and he knew how to take care of himself. He then straightway trotted about in the rain. He was stricken down with pneumonia, and within 4 days he was on his way back to the coast in a coffin. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. American Industry in the Heart of Peru. The story of the mines of Cerro de Pasco began about 3 centuries ago. In the year 1630, an Indian shepherd who had strayed far from his hut with his llamas and sheep was obliged to camp out overnight. When he awoke the next morning, he found the rocks under the ashes of his campfire specked with globules of silver that had been melted by the heat. That discovery led to the opening of mines by the Spaniards, who drove the Indian peons into the workings and flogged them when the output lagged behind. Later, the mines passed in the possession of Cholos. At one time, when the price of silver was at its highest, the deposits were exploited by capitalists who paid the miners something like 40 cents a day for 12 hours' work, with an ounce of coca leaves as an added inducement to keep them on the job. Although the Cerro de Pasco mines produced an average of 1.5 million ounces of silver a year from the time of their discovery until 1900, their greatest value today is in their copper. As the workings grew deeper, the ore yielded more and more of that metal and less of silver. Near the surface, it often assayed 100 ounces of silver to the ton, but at the depth of the present operations, the silver content is less than 10 ounces. Nevertheless, Cerro de Pasco is still one of the 2 most important silver districts of Peru, and Peru ranks 3rd among the silver-producing countries of the world. Only the United States and Mexico surpass it. Although the most valuable deposits here are owned by the Cerro de Pasco Copper Corporation, small holdings are still worked by the Indians for both silver and copper. The natives dig out the best ore with picks and bring it to the surface on their backs, in rawhide sacks, one man carrying from 60 to 80 pounds at a time. Some of it is brought up on ladders from a depth of 200 feet or more. The ground under Cerro de Pasco is honeycombed with the diggings out of which the ore has been taken for generations. Here and there on the surface are piles of ore, and everywhere are holes leading down into the native mines. Some of them are so close to the houses that I wonder that the babies toddling about do not fall in. In places the ground has sunk, and as I rode through the town I saw great pits, large enough to swallow the Vatican at Rome or our National Cathedral at Washington. If the houses were built of heavier materials, it is probable that the whole town would drop down into the excavations beneath it. It was the great copper value of the ore that first attracted the attention of American capitalists to Cerro de Pasco about a generation ago. A syndicate including such men as J.B. Hagen, Henry C. Frick, the Vanderbilts, the Hearst Estate, and others was formed to buy the most valuable mines. No expense was spared in developing the properties, the company spending tens of millions of dollars to put them on a paying basis. This was accomplished in a few years, and their total mineral production now reaches an annual value of more than $40 million. The extent of the present operations of the Cerro de Pasco Copper Corporation is almost inconceivable. Here on the top of the Andes, the company has built up one of the greatest copper mining and smelting industries in the world. I have already described its railway from Arroyo to Cerro de Pasco. It has also built a railway that runs about 25 miles north of Cerro de Pasco to the coal mines that supply the fuel for smelting the ore. At Arroyo, it has a 20,000 horsepower hydroelectric plant that furnishes the power for its various properties, and a new smelter that surpasses any on the South American continent. At La Fundición, the site of its old smelter, it operates enormous ovens for making the coke used in smelting, and it has its own quarries of limestone. It owns also several other copper mines at Moracocha, which is reached by a branch line from the Peruvian Central. The company employs from 6 to 8,000 Indians and Cholos in the mines and the smelter. As a rule, they make good workmen. They are divided into 2 8-hour shifts, so arranged that the second stops at 2 o'clock in the morning, thus enabling all the men to sleep a part of the night. The prosperity of Cerro de Pasco, and indeed of this whole mining region, is dependent largely upon American capital. The corporation spends thousands of dollars a month in wages. The ores shipped to Callao and the supplies for the mines furnish the bulk of the freight business of the Central Railway. The company has great warehouses that stock everything in the line of mining and smelting machinery, as well as all sorts of supplies for its employees. Near one of the shafts, I saw a lumber yard stacked high with Oregon pine, and was told that it was cheaper to bring the timber over its long ocean trip and then carry it up the Andes by railroad than to get the eucalyptus that grows in eastern Peru, not more than 200 miles from the smelter, but far away from any railway. It is doubtful whether there is any other place in the world where the copper deposits are of such enormous extent as here at Cerro de Pasco. "You might compare the formations to your hand," said one of the superintendents in describing them to me. "Let the palm represent the great central mass of copper, and your fingers the veins that extend out from it. On one of the veins alone, there is enough ore in sight to keep us busy for 10 years or more, and it's my opinion that we have barely scratched the surface of the copper. In the United States, we consider a mine a good one if it will yield 1 or 2% of copper to the ton. Here we throw the ore away if it does not assay 2%. Our average is from 8 to 14%, and we have taken out some rock that has yielded 40% to the ton. On my visit to the mines, I dropped down to the 400-foot level and then rode through the narrow tunnels on one of the electric trains that carry the ore to the shaft. There are 5 shafts going down into the earth, one of them 800 feet deep. Tests have been made showing that the copper extends even below that level. There are about 40 miles of tunnels, most of them so small that I could hardly stand upright in them, while from the center of the track I could easily reach the sides of the walls. Some of them are reinforced with timber, but nearly everywhere the excavating is so expertly done that the rock needs no additional support. As we went from chamber to chamber, we stopped at times to watch the miners operating compressed air drills and taking out the ore blasted loose from the rock walls. Everywhere I was impressed by the efficient methods employed, and I was particularly interested in the way the value of ore specimens was determined without a chemical assay. This is done by holding the ore to the flame of an ordinary tallow candle. The copper gives a green color to the flame, by the intensity of which the experts can tell just about the percentage of metal the ore contains. The assistant manager made such a test for me, which showed that the sample averaged about 12% copper. In addition, the ore contains enough silver and gold practically to pay the cost of mining, making the value of the copper almost clear profit. Until a few years ago, the ore was sent to the smelter at La Fundición, not far from Cerro de Pasco. Before the erection of that plant, no smelter had ever been built at more than 14,000 feet above the sea, and at first the experts said that furnaces could not be operated at that altitude. They claimed that the thinness of the air would make it almost impossible to get the amount of oxygen needed for the blasts. Nevertheless, the syndicate determined to try the experiment. The furnaces were installed by the best engineers obtainable, but still they would not work, and one mining expert after another came here, threw up his hands in despair, and left. For a time it looked as though this great mining venture, which had already cost millions of dollars, would fail. At last came an engineer from Mexico, who experimented with the blasts until he finally was able to get satisfactory results. The gigantic smelter was then completed and successfully operated until it was abandoned in 1922. In the meantime, a new and much larger smelter had been built at Oroya at a cost of $15 million. The altitude of that town is 2,000 feet lower than that of La Fundición, and the heavier atmosphere makes it possible to operate the blast furnaces and converters with less difficulty. The Oroya smelter also had the advantage of being nearer to the company's Morococha mines and to Callao, the chief port of the country. The white employees of the smelter live in the company's model village of Chulik, which has been built far enough away to be free from the sulfur fumes. As in Cerro de Pasco, there are modern clubhouses for single men and a hospital in charge of American physicians and nurses. The guest house or hotel is unique in this part of the world. It has an up-to-date garage, an attractive patio, a glass-covered pergola, and modern bathrooms. Even the servants' quarters are equipped with showers, and though the Quichuas, as a race, are notoriously lax in the matter of personal cleanliness, the ones employed here find themselves looking for new jobs if they do not make frequent use of their bathing facilities. Homes of adobe or brick are furnished to the Indian employees, a low rent being charged chiefly to keep the natives from thinking the houses belong to them. I wish I could take you through this great monument of American industry and show you the stream of ore that comes in over the railway and is fed to the fiery furnaces. Used by the Incas and later by the Spaniards, the old tunnels are now being cleaned out and reworked, and new workings have been begun at still lower levels. Not far from La Fundición are great deposits of vanadium, owned also by an American corporation. One of the most valuable mines formerly belonged to an Italian, who later invested his wealth in vast haciendas and fine breeds of stock. Peru now furnishes 70% of the world's supply of vanadium. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. By roller coaster down the Andes. Today I am again near sea level and thankful to be safely down from the land of the skies. Yesterday I was on the roof of South America. Now I am back at Lima, only a step from the ocean. The return trip furnished enough thrills to last me a lifetime, and it seems almost a miracle that I am here to describe it. Imagine, if you can, coasting down the side of the Andes on the steepest railroad in the world. Think of being now blinded in a blizzard and now pelted with hailstones driven into your face with the force of a gale. Sometimes the storm was so thick I could not see a stone's throw ahead. Again, we were coasting along under blue skies and bright sunshine. One moment we hung to the edge of a precipice, the next we were flying over spiderweb bridges of steel that spanned frightful chasms. We whirled about curves in the midnight blackness of mountain tunnels and burst again into the light of day, only to shudder at the vast depths below. All this can give you but a faint idea of my descent from the glacial snows of the Peruvian peaks, 3 miles high in the air. It was a journey filled with dangers that were terrifyingly real, and before I started, where the conditions seemed ideal, I was required to sign a paper swearing that my heirs would claim no damages in case I was killed. An hour later, it seemed to me that the railroad authorities were more sensible to require such a protection than I was to travel in such fashion. The trip was made on the gravity car of the general manager of the Central Railway of Peru. It was merely a low platform mounted on wheels about 2 feet high. It had no motive power and was controlled only by two brakes, one on each side at the front. On the platform was a seat wide enough for three persons, and as we took our places, I sat in the middle with my stenographer at my left and one of the officials of the operating department of the railway at my right. The brakes were manned by a cholo. We had to run upon schedule time, for we were on a single track road and would have to pass both east and westbound trains on the way. We were to get our orders from the telegraph operators at the principal stations. We started at Ticlio amid the glaciers at the very top of the pass, and we could see clearly the great masses of ice on the mountainsides. Just above us was Mount Meigs, and all around were mighty peaks, The sun was shining, there were no clouds, and I was told that we should have no trouble in controlling the car, as the only danger comes from rain or snow, which makes it difficult for the wheels to hold to the rails. We let go the brakes and fairly shot down the track. We had hardly left Ticlio, however, before the sky changed and the winds began to blow up the gorges. The air grew cold, and within 5 minutes we were in the midst of a snowstorm. A moment later, the snow turned to hail. The stones were as big as peas, and they bounced like rubber as they fell. With the hail came thunder and flashes of lightning. In the rare air, our ears fairly cracked with the sound, and the lightning made more visible the dangers about us. As we went on, the rails became white, and the rocks were hidden in snow. Our car was soon half full of hail, and the tracks became more and more slippery. Then the wind increased to a gale, and my stenographer, who was taking his notes on wet paper, notwithstanding the storm, cried out that his hat had blown off. Very foolishly, we stopped the car and sent the Cholo brakeman back up the track. At this time, we were only 10 minutes ahead of a train that was following us. We waited 5 minutes, but the Cholo did not return. Then my secretary went back and recovered his hat about 200 yards from the car on the edge of a 400-foot cliff. The Cholo had disappeared. We waited for him 2 minutes longer, and then hearing the whistle of the downcoming train, we knew we should have to go on and manage the car ourselves. My companions manned the brakes on either side, and we began again to coast down through the storm. I learned afterward that no trace was ever found of the brakeman, and that he must have fallen over the cliff in the blinding snowstorm. The cold was piercing, the wind went through our clothing, and the great hailstones cut our face. At times, when the clouds were the blackest, we could see only a few feet ahead, but could look down the sides of the cliff to which the track clings and see the snow-clad walls far below us. Now we would be flying into tunnels, which were the safest places, for there the rails were dry and the wheels did not slip when the brakes were put on. Indeed, we almost prayed for the tunnels and were glad when we dashed out of the blinding sleet into the darkness. Suddenly, we saw ahead two trains standing on a siding at one of the switchbacks. They were waiting for us, and the engineer said another train coming up must pass before we could go on. By that time, we were chilled to the bone, and our faces were blue with the sleet and the cold. We climbed out of our car and into the cab of one of the oil-burning engines. The heat of the boiler soon thawed us out, and within a short time dried our clothes, which had been wet by the snow. We were still in the storm when we left the switchback. The rails were covered with sleet, and we could not be sure of the track. At one place we passed a gang of laborers working on the roadbed, and at another time nearly missed a drove of llamas crossing the track. As they saw us rushing toward them, the animals began to run, leaping along in kangaroo jumps, with their Indian drivers trotting behind. At every hamlet along the way, the dogs ran out and barked at the car and snapped at us as we flew by. The danger was that a dog might get in front of the car and throw it off the track and down the sides of the mountain. When it rains in the Andes, masses of earth and rock fall down upon the track, but we were going too fast, and the storm was too thick to try to watch for slides. By and by we passed Casapalca, where we dropped down out of the storm. The sun came out again, the sky was blue, and we could see for miles. The track dried, and we coasted along at great speed through some of the most wonderful scenery on earth. Now we rode for miles between walls of rock that extended upward for thousands of feet, and now hung over gorges at the bottom of which, 1,000 feet below, rushed the foaming Rimac. Now we entered a tunnel high up on the side of a cliff, and looking down, saw another tunnel almost directly below us. We rushed out of one tunnel into the Infernillo, where a slender bridge of iron joins two great walls of rock. Above us, through the narrow slit of the canyon, was the blue sky of heaven, and below was the gorge that these people call the Little Hell. The bridge there spans a chasm 2,000 feet deep, and we trembled at the thought that there might be a train in the tunnel beyond. The whole of this wonderful railroad seems blasted out of the sides of the mountains. Here it hangs to the cliffs, There it bores through the rocks, and again it zigzags back and forth in great loops. Some of the tunnels are so close together that they made me think of the road between Monte Carlo and Nice, a trip on which has been described as "riding through a flute and looking out of the holes." I wish I could show you the formations of the Andes. They surpass in some of their wonders the Alps and the Rockies, and I have seen nothing like them in the Himalayas. We have a little patch of 400 acres in Colorado in the foothills of the Rockies that we call the Garden of the Gods. Not far from Cerro de Pasco, in the heart of the Andes, near the railway from Oroya, is a similar garden with hundreds of weird formations for every one in Colorado. It lies at an altitude 500 feet higher than the top of Pike's Peak, and is looked down upon by mountain peaks from 17 to 20,000 feet high. It is 20 miles long and between 3 and 5 miles wide, and its area is completely covered with natural arches, walls, temples, and rocks of all shapes and sizes. One of these rocks, called the King, is a gigantic figure as tall as a house. Its head is poised upon a neck not more than 3 feet in diameter, but so long that it towers high above all its surroundings. Another rock is known as the Turtle. It is a gigantic block shaped like a tortoise, and the natives believe that it upholds the world. A third looks like a great steamboat perched on a pedestal, and a fourth is a mighty tower. In the same region is the rock forest, consisting of hundreds of acres of columns standing out on the plain. At a distance, they look like a great wood that has been burned over. And then there are castles, palaces, and fortifications. With a little imagination, you can find almost any kind of architecture or the model of any great structure. In South Africa, I have seen Table Rock, which hangs over the harbor at Cape Town. There are table rocks of marble here in the Andes that look as though they had been cut by a sculptor. There are formations like those of the Giant's Causeway in Ireland, although they are not of hexagonal shape, and in riding through the mountains, I have seen castles of the purest white marble, which in their grandeur excel the ruins of those mighty works of man on the Rhine. These mountains have all the colors of the Grand Canyon of the Colorado. Now the rocks are blazing white, and now they remind one of the rusted marbles of the Parthenon at Athens. Here they are brown, farther on they are blue, red, or drab. Drab is the predominant color near the sea, where much of the formation is limestone. Now the mountains are ragged and rough and rise in ruined cities. I saw some the color of old red sandstone that made me think of the fortifications at Delhi in India. I saw others that were spired like the cathedrals of Cologne and Milan. These spires are as white as Carrara marble, and they glisten like snow under the sun. Other rocks are dome-shaped, and still others extend in great waves, showing the folds in the earth and forming curving walls of wonderful beauty. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Arequipa, City of the Stars. I have now come to Arequipa, the metropolis of southern Peru. It is situated 100 miles inland from Mollendo, which ranks next to Callao as a commercial port. Nevertheless, it has such a poor harbor that ships have to anchor far out from the shore, and the swell is worse than that at Jaffa, which tossed Jonah's ship so that the sailors threw him out to the whale. The Mollendo harbor is partially protected by a small breakwater, but the ocean is often so rough that passengers have to be lifted by steam cranes out of the small boats that bring them to the dock from the steamer, and goods have to be put on and off the boats in the same way. The sea was tamer than usual when I came into port, but my boat rose and fell 8 or 10 feet with each wave, and I had to make a flying leap from one of the seats to the steps that led to the custom house. There has been some talk of transferring the port from Arequipa from Mollendo to Matarani, 8 miles to the north, which has a good harbor. Such a move would also shorten the railway route over the mountains. I wish I could take you over the route of the journey I made up the Andes from Molendo to Arequipa. The country is even more dreary and wild than that above Lima. I rode for miles without seeing a blade of grass or anything green. I saw shifting sand dunes and bluffs that had been ground so smooth by the wind-blown sand that the strata could be plainly seen. Farther on, the sand had cut into the rock of the mountains, making furrows in it like the wrinkles on an old woman's face. In many places, the rocks have been ground to a powder. These slopes get no rain whatever, and water for the stations along the way, as well as for Molendo, is piped from Arequipa. As we went on, it seemed as though the skin of vegetation and life had been peeled from the earth, and that we could see the great ball as it was before plant or animal life had sprung into being. All around us was nothing but rock, and there was not a bit of soil in sight. At the same time, the scenery was magnificent, and the air was so clear I could see for miles. The clouds painted spots of purple velvet on the hills all through the afternoon, and toward evening the sun tinted the mountains with delicate shades of blue, pink, lavender, and mauve, until they looked like a mighty picture sketched by the hands of the gods on the canvas of the sky. As we started out, we could see the spray dashing high up on the beach, and at the close of our journey, the moon was just rising over the snow of the mountains above old Arequipa. The trip made a panorama such as I have seen nowhere else, and such as I venture can be seen in no other place. Arequipa is built in an oasis made by the Chili River in the arid Andes of this Pacific coast desert. It is walled in by ragged, dry mountains, but bedded in a valley of perpetual green. A legend regarding its origin relates that a party of Quechua Indians under an Inca leader came upon this beautiful little oasis after a long march through the bare and dusty mountain slopes of the surrounding desert. Upon their asking the Inca to be allowed to stay on that fertile and peaceful spot, he replied, "Arequipa," which in the Quechua language means "yes, remain." Arequipa is about 7,600 feet above the sea, or a mile and a half higher than Philadelphia. Some of the mountains about it are 4 miles in height. Just behind it is the great volcano, Mount Misti, which has a crater a half mile in diameter. To the left of Misti is Chachani, more than 20,000 feet high, and beyond are Picchu Picchu and other Andean giants. Indeed, there is no city anywhere in South America more beautifully located, and you will go far before you will find one that is so fresh, so bright, and so quaint. The houses of Arequipa look as though they had just come fresh from a toy shop of the giants. I bought my postage stamps today in a building the color of old rose. I ate my breakfast in a restaurant painted sky blue, and next door was a house the color of strawberry ice cream. This morning I visited the new market of Arequipa. Its walls are built of pink and white stone. The surrounding buildings are of similar bright colors, and the whole seems to fit in with the air of southern Peru. But come with me into the market. This will show us why the city of Arequipa has been built where it is. The merchandise you see comes from the valley of the Chili River, which contains about 50 square miles of cultivated land. This oasis valley produces grain, alfalfa, and fruit, raises cattle and sheep, and makes Arequipa an important trading center. As we go through the market, we see everywhere evidences of the fertility of the soil and the wonderful climate. Nearly every fruit that can be raised in the United States is on sale here. There are apricots, peaches, apples, and plums, and strawberries as big as a walnut. There are oranges and lemons, bananas and figs, and bushels of alligator pears. There are green watermelons, some of which are as red inside as any that ever made a darkie's mouth water, and others with flesh as yellow as gold, although the seeds are jet black. In the vegetable stalls, we find fully as great a variety. It is now midwinter in the United States, but here below the equator it is summer, and we see new potatoes and fresh green corn. There are bright red tomatoes, white cauliflowers, and great quantities of cabbages, as well as yuccas, sweet potatoes, and yams. Arequipa is the chief wool market of Peru. The leading exporting houses of this city have their agents in all parts of the Andean Plateau, where they buy vast quantities of vicuna, alpaca, and sheep's wool from the Indians and Basidendos. The wool is sent overland to Lake Titicaca and from there by rail to Arequipa. Some of it is consumed in the woolen mills of Peru, but the bulk of the product is sent to Europe and the United States. Besides being a market town, Arequipa makes harness and saddlery, boots and shoes, and it has large cotton, chocolate, and flour mills. The Southern Railway of Peru has its headquarters here, and also its shops, which employ about 500 men in building passenger and freight cars, as well as making all the repairs on its rolling stock. This line is one of the three chief gateways to La Paz, the capital of Bolivia. Travelers bound for La Paz and Cusco often stop a day or so in Arequipa in order to make a more gradual ascent from the coast to the rarefied atmosphere of the highlands. And as this travel has increased since the opening of the Panama Canal, there has been a marked improvement in the hotel accommodations. In addition to a fairly good hotel, there is a boarding house run by an American woman that is famous all over the West Coast for its comfort and good food. Formerly, the chief hotel was kept by an Italian who quartered his guests on one side of the plaza and fed them on the other side in a long, low comedor or dining room. When I visited Arequipa in 1898, it was lighted by kerosene, and I do not remember that it had a car line. It has now an electric light plant run by water power and also an excellent system of tramways that extend out into the country. It is well equipped with telephones and long-distance messages that can be sent at low rates. I find Arequipa quite as interesting as Lima. It has a great cathedral of white stone that covers an acre or so of ground. It faces the plaza, occupying the whole of one side of the square. The other three sides are lined with stores as quaint as any I have ever seen in Europe. The buildings are of only one story, and in front of them extend wide portales, or corridors, with huge columns separating them from the plaza. On the other side of the corridors is a row of cave-like shops, lighted only from the front and the roof. The stores are 15 or 20 feet wide and 30 or more feet deep, and with their arched ceilings, they look like vaults. The goods, which include many articles made in the United States, are hung from the ceilings and piled up on the floors. Nearly all the houses of Arequipa have vaulted roofs, which on some of the one-story structures extend up in oval domes or hoods. The city has had many serious earthquakes, and for this reason the skyscraper will never be known here. Even a five-story building would be the talk of the town. Arequipa is one of the oldest cities in America, dating back almost to the days of Pizarro. It is a place of old families and the center of culture for southern Peru, as well as an ecclesiastical and political headquarters. There are a university and several colleges here, and also a school of arts and an agricultural institute. Moreover, this city boasts of having the best hospital in South America, although the climate is unusually healthful and the death rate is low. I doubt whether you will find many places that have finer weather all the year around than Arequipa. The sky is almost always blue, and the days are sunny from morning to night. Indeed, the belief that this region has more clear weather than almost any other locality on earth was responsible for the establishment here of the Harvard University Observatory. This is one of the most noted astronomical stations of the world. It is situated on the slope of Mount Misti, 500 feet above Arequipa, where the observers can have an unobstructed view of the heavens. The observatory is equipped with great telescopes, one of which has a lens 2 feet in diameter, enabling the scientists to take photographs on plates 14 by 17 inches in size. The tube of that giant instrument is so delicately balanced that a child could move it. The Harvard scientists have taken as many as 50 photographs in a night and thousands in a year. After being developed, the negatives are shipped to Cambridge, where there are now more than 100,000 of them available. There is, I am told, nothing duplicated in the sky. Each half of the world has its own stars and constellations, and there are some here that we never see in the north. One of them is the famous Southern Cross, but it seems to me that its beauty has been greatly exaggerated. There are only 4 stars in it, and they are so small that one has to look hard to find them. It does not compare with the Big Dipper. Many of the other stars are far more brilliant than in the north. This is so of the Milky Way and of most of the planets. I have been on the equator when the path of a planet on the still waters of the ocean was almost as well marked as the reflection of the moon, and in riding at night up the Amazon River, the stars seemed so close that I felt as though I could almost reach out and grasp them. The story of the establishment of this observatory is interesting. It was near the end of the 19th century when Uriah H. Borden died and left $200,000 to Harvard University, with the stipulation that the money was to be used to build an observatory at the best place on Earth for the study of the stars. The authorities tried Colorado and California, and then came to South America. Their first work was done back of Lima on what is now called Mount Harvard, but in 1891 they moved their station to Arequipa. The university astronomers have been working here ever since. In 1892, the scientists established a meteorological station on Mount Chichani at an elevation of 16,650 feet. This was moved the following year to the top of Mount Misty. Mount Misty is 19,200 feet high, so that this weather station is the loftiest of its kind in the world. It is higher than any point in North America outside Alaska, and it is fully a mile above the observatory on the top of Pike's Peak. The site of the station is on the edge of the huge crater, which at times sends clouds of sulfurous yellow vapor 1,000 feet into the air. At other times, I am told, the volcano spits out hot water and steam. The automatic instruments installed on the mountain will run several months without rewinding. They keep a continuous record of temperatures, rainfall, air pressure, humidity, the direction and velocity of the winds, and of other conditions of the atmosphere, and the scientists need only visit the station at intervals to note the results. The machines work with great regularity, but sometimes the mountain is so covered with snow and at other times swept by such gales that there is now and then an interruption in the records. Although the station is only 11 miles in a straight line from the observatory, it is 40 miles distant by way of the road built to the summit of the mountain. The trip up to it is made on muleback, travelers spending the night at a hut at the base of the peak. One of the first huts erected on the trail stood at an altitude of more than 16,000 feet. It was known as the Inn of the Water of Miracles because of an old legend that the Lord appeared here and caused water to flow from the ground. This spring, the Indians say, is the same one that is still bubbling away near the hut. Professor Bailey, who established the station, had great difficulty in transporting his instruments to the mountaintop. A large number of mules and Indians was needed to carry the material, as they still do today. The Indians then regarded Misty with superstition, and when they found an iron cross standing on the mountaintop, they fell down and worshipped. This cross is said to have been set up in 1677 by a party of Spanish priests who had gone there to offer prayers to Misty that the city of Arequipa might be made free from earthquakes. The Spaniards found at the summit of the mountain the remains of stone structures that have now disappeared, and it is believed that the crater was the scene of sacrificial rites and ceremonies held by a people long before the time of the Incas. End of chapter 15. Chapter 16 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Farming in the Land of the Sky. My present destination is Cusco, the ancient Inca capital, far up in the Andes. By fast trains, it is possible to go all the way from Molendo to Cusco within 3 days, but I am taking several more for the journey in order that I may better see the country and the people. From Arequipa, I cross the pass of Crucero Alto, the highest on the route of the Southern Railway of Peru, and then drop down to Juliaca, which has an altitude of less than 13,000 feet. Juliaca is the junction where the Southern Railway divides, one branch going southward to Puno on Lake Titicaca. The other branch, the one I took, goes north over the great plateau to Cuzco. I am now at Sicuani, a little town only 100 miles or so from Cuzco, and I shall go on to that famous city tomorrow. Sicuani is east of the western range of the Andes, and it was in a driving snowstorm that I slid over the mountains from the Pacific slope to the plateau. The journey from Arequipa to the top of the mountains is even more marvelous than the first part of the trip over the desert from Malindo. I wound my way around Mount Misti, and higher still saw mountains covered with glaciers, some of them of enormous extent. The greater part of the way was through a region of extinct volcanoes. The slope of Mount Misti is covered with great blocks of black lava, and the mountains that wall this high valley where I now am have Niagaras of lava that seem to have frozen as they flowed down the slopes from the craters above. In places I could look over walls of such rock 1,000 feet high, and above them, on mountains that are more than 4 miles in height, could see glaciers. At times these mountains rise up like great white ramparts of irregular shape, and again they extend in a sawtooth formation as far as the eye can see. Everywhere along the railroad are irrigated valleys. The streams are small, but even a little water makes the desert a garden. Along the course of the Chili River is a strip of green, and about Arequipa, wheat, barley, corn, and all the vegetables and fruits of the tropic and temperate zones are raised. The vegetation changes as one nears the top of the Andes. At an altitude of 2 miles or more, grass begins to sprinkle the semi-arid hillsides, and as soon as we crossed the pass and came down to the plateau, we were in a region of sod covered with tufts of wiry grass. The new sprouts of this grass are eaten by cattle, but most of it is so coarse that only the llamas will feed on it. The plateau is covered with tens of thousands of cattle and millions of sheep and alpacas. At every few miles are Indian villages, and in places the plain is dotted with low mud huts roofed with straw, each of which is the home of an Indian who grazes his alpacas and llamas close by. Near every hut is a small patch of potatoes, barley, or quinoa. Quinoa is a plant something like pigweed, from the seeds of which the Indians make a sort of mush. The average altitude of this region is from 12 to 13,000 feet above the sea, and some places are more than 14,000 feet high. There are millions of acres of land in the plateau with a climate in which white men can live, and a land development scheme has been inaugurated by the Peruvian Corporation, the British company that operates many of the government railways. This company, sent to the United States for an agricultural expert to determine what grasses and grains are best adapted for cultivation on the plateau. I met this man at Juliaca and went with him to some of the experimental farms. He showed me a field of 4 or 5 acres near the railroad planted to cereals and grasses of various kinds. One plot of barley consisted of perhaps 50 rows, each row grown from seed gathered from a different part of the world. Some came from Smyrna, some from Yugoslavia, some from Russia, and some from the western highlands of the United States. Other rows were from seed brought from Manchuria and the plateaus of India and Tibet. All of these barleys were doing well, and many of them looked better than the native Peruvian grain. There seems to be no doubt that almost any kind of hardy barley can be raised on the plateau, and that these experiments will greatly contribute to farm progress on the highlands of Peru. The plateau was once part of the basin of Lake Titicaca, and its soil is rich and almost free from stones. There are millions of acres of it that have never been touched by the plow. Indeed, it is doubtful whether any of it has ever been thoroughly cultivated. The Indians use plows made of wood that cut the ground to a depth of only 3 inches. They work bullocks as draft animals and farm the same way that their ancestors did generations ago. Even so, they raise fairly good crops. The most common farm implement used by the Indians is a kind of foot plow called a tacla in the Quechua language. It consists of a wooden handle 5 or 6 feet long, shod with an iron point. On the left side, as the Indian holds it, are two projections from the handle, one for his foot and one for his hand, to aid in forcing it into the earth. This primitive plow, though handled somewhat like a spade, is not used to turn over the ground, but only to loosen it. Two men always work together side by side, so that their tuklas lift up the same piece of sod. A boy or woman works along with them, kneeling on the ground and turning up the loosened earth. A similar implement is found still in use in parts of Scotland and in the Hebrides Islands. We next went to the plots where experiments are being made with hardy grasses. There I saw American timothy and red clover sprouting through the brown soil. I saw patches of Russian grasses growing luxuriantly, and also wheat grasses from our western plains, as well as a member of one of the families of bluegrass that thrive on the high plateau of the Rockies. From the plateau, the railroad drops down into the valley in which Cusco is located. This valley is a series of little gardens of Eden, and there are cultivated lands along both sides of the Vilcanota River. The fields are in terraces, green with luxuriant crops, and the water is carried out over them so that it falls from level to level. In coming to Sikuani, I saw many patches of barley, potatoes, and beans, and also hundreds of little fields of Indian corn. In the upper altitudes, this crop reaches to the height of my knee, but where the lands are a little lower, and consequently warmer, it grows as high as my shoulder. I am told that in the valley near Cusco, through which I shall go tomorrow, the crops are still more advanced, and that the barley, which is green in the highlands, is there almost ready for harvest. The irrigated land of the valley is exceedingly valuable, and has all been taken up by whites or cholos, who are exploiting it with Indian labor. The chief industry of the Peruvian plateau is stock raising rather than farming. The climate at an altitude of 12,000 feet is warm during the day, and even in the coldest of weather, the thermometer does not drop below zero at night. Therefore, the sheep and cattle can feed out of doors all the year round. When snow falls, the hot sun melts it in an hour or so. About the most dangerous features of the weather are thunderstorms, with their accompanying lightning, which often kills people and sheep. The plateau has two seasons, dry and wet. The wet season begins in September or October and lasts until April or May. During that time, it is usually clear in the morning, with rain or snow in the afternoon. The dry season, which is from May to September, is delightfully clear. The sky is always blue, and the tropical sun makes the weather much like Indian summer in the Virginia mountains, which I believe is the very best weather on earth. On my trip over the Central Railway to Cerro de Pasco, I passed flock after flock of fat sheep with tails as big around as my arm. To my eyes, there seemed to be nothing for them to eat, but they managed to live and grow fat on the moss and the thin, fuzzy grass. Some of the large flocks are owned by rich capitalists. There is one firm near Cerro de Pasco that has 60,000 or more. There are also hundreds of squatters, Indians or cholos, each of whom raises a few sheep every year. I saw watching over the flocks boys and girls of 10 or 12 years of age, who knitted or spun as they cared for the sheep. Some of the great haciendas of the high Andes yield large incomes. There is one near La Fundición that produces tens of thousands of pounds of wool every year. It belongs to a company in Lima and is managed by a Scotchman who employs only Scotch shepherds. This ranch has 36,000 sheep, which are kept in fenced fields. The manager is making many experiments in introducing new blood into the flocks, and he is also crossing Scotch collie dogs with the native dogs of Peru to produce a breed especially suited to conditions on the high Andes. An Italian in this section is experimenting in bringing in fancy breeds of cattle. He has a number of large haciendas and expects to supply the meat market of the coast. This same man owns thousands of llamas and donkeys and is said to have almost a monopoly on the freight business about Cerro de Pasco. I never tire of watching the llamas. They crowd the streets of the villages, droves of them line the plazas of every city and town, and I have often met long caravans of them being driven across the plain. They are, in fact, competing with the railroads as the common carriers of the Andes. They transport grain, vegetables, hides, alcohol, coca leaves, and goods of every description. Many of them are used to convey the ore from the mines to the smelters, and the farmers use them to take their produce to the towns and railroads. The llamas carry their burdens tied on their backs like a saddle, and not in the panniers used with donkeys. There is tradition that a llama will carry just 100 pounds, and that if 1 ounce more is added, he will lie down, and no whipping or beating can make him go on. This statement is ridiculous. The llama, if overburdened, will surely lie down and refuse to move, but that he has the intelligence to know when the 100-pound load is reached is one of the fictions of the modern Munchausens. Indeed, there are very few llamas that can carry as much as 100 pounds, although there are some of the beasts that will carry 120. The average load is about 75 or 80 pounds. The llamas are of different sizes, according to their ages and the care they have received. When full grown, their heads reach a height of 6 feet or more, but their long, straight necks make them look taller. They have long ears that stand up like those of a fox terrier. They have full, round bodies like that of a sheep and comparatively long legs. They look like miniature camels, and like the camel, they can go for several days without food or water. Many of the farms are remote from the towns or the railroads, and a llama has often to make a journey of 4 or 5 days or a week in carrying his load to its destination and bringing another back. During this time, I am told that he eats practically nothing and gets along without water. The wool of the llama, as I have said, is coarse and has no value in commerce, although it is used by the Indians for spinning thread and making rough cloth. The meat also is too coarse for the markets. The alpacas are much smaller than the llamas and do not look so much like camels, having shorter necks. They are more delicate and are not used as beasts of burden, although there are crosses between the alpaca and the llama that serve as freight carriers. They are usually to be seen in the llama trains and are often of a brownish-yellow color. The alpacas one sees on the pastures, and there are millions of them on the high Andes, are white, black, or brown, and sometimes spotted. They do not thrive anywhere below a mile above the sea, and they usually are found at a height of 2 miles or more. The grass they are accustomed to eat on the high plateau is short and fine, and they eat it down so close to the ground that the sand keeps their teeth worn down. In the luxuriant grass of the lowlands, their teeth often grow so long that they cannot graze. The wool of the alpaca is very fine and often more than 8 inches long. It brings about twice as much a pound as sheep's wool. Usually the animals are clipped every 2 years, when the average fleece should weigh 5 pounds. In some years, nearly 4 million pounds of alpaca wool is shipped to England for manufacture. 3/4 of the entire supply of the world comes from Peru. I have seen some vicunas during my travels through the Andes. They are the wild half-sisters and half-brothers of the llamas and alpacas, and are smaller than either. They cannot be domesticated, but they will sometime come down from the mountains and mix with the flocks of llamas, alpacas, and sheep on the plains. They are often shot by the Indians and cholos, although this is against the law. The vicuna wool is finer than that of the alpaca, and it brings a high price. There is so little of it, however, that it is hardly worth mentioning, much of the so-called vicuna cloth being really made of alpaca wool. The yellow, woolly fur of the vicuna is as soft as a sealskin coat, and for this reason, the pelts are used to make the rugs so highly prized by tourists. These rugs vary in value according to the part of the animal from which they come. A rug made from the necks or legs is much more valuable than one from pieces taken from the rest of the body. During a previous visit to South America, I bought a beautiful vicuna rug in La Paz for about $20 in gold. I am told that similar ones now cost $50 and more. The vicuna has been crossed with the alpaca, producing the animal known as the Paco vicuna, which can be domesticated. Its wool is especially valuable, combining the lengths of alpaca wool with the silkiness of the vicuna. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The ancient capital of the Incas. Come with me this morning for a stroll through Cuzco, the ancient capital of the Incas, that wonderful people who ruled most of western South America until about 400 years ago. Like the reigning dynasties of old Japan and Egypt, they believed themselves to be descended from the gods, and they called themselves the children of the sun. One tradition tells that the Incas sprang into existence on one of the islands of Lake Titicaca. A prince and princess of the race, Manco Capac, and his wife, who was also his sister, were given a golden rod by the sun god and directed to go forth and civilize the savages who then inhabited the high plateau of the Andes. They were told to build a city wherever that rod should sink into the earth. They traveled across the plateau over much the same route by which I came on the railroad, and when they reached this spot, the golden rod fell and disappeared into the ground. They established their capital on the site of Cuzco, on the slope of the mountain overlooking a beautiful and fertile valley in the heart of the Andes. That was hundreds of years before Columbus discovered America, and the empire then founded was from 4 to 6 centuries old when it was destroyed by the Spaniards. The Incas first cultivated the valley of Cuzco, and then gradually conquered the neighboring regions until their dominions extended northward far beyond Quito and south of where the capital of Chile now stands. They had subjects all along the eastern slopes of the Andes, and the western limit of their rule was the mighty Pacific. They governed a country as long as the distance between the Arctic Ocean and the shores of Lake Erie, and larger than all the United States east of the Mississippi Valley. Their subjects were numbered by the tens of millions. The Incas built a road through their territory from Lake Titicaca to Quito, the remains of which can still be found. As there were no wheeled vehicles at the time, the highway was in many places not wide enough for the cart or automobile of today, but it was nevertheless a difficult piece of construction. In places it went up and down steps cut into the steep mountain slopes, in others it wound around obstacles, and many times it narrowed to a mere path in which the Indians had to walk single file. At the time they were overthrown by the Spaniards, the Incas had divided the country into provinces, ruled by viceroys and subordinate officials. They had not only subdued the savages, but civilized them as well, making them into farmers, mechanics, and artisans. In their religion, they recognized the sun as the lord of the world, and their emperor as his representative on earth. One of their prayers was somewhat as follows: O conquering and ever-present Creator, thou who gavest life and strength to mankind, saying, Let this be a man, and let this be a woman, thou who vouchsafest that man shall live in health and peace, thou who dwelleth in the heights, in the storm clouds, and in the thunder, hear us and have us in thy keeping. Thou who art without equal unto the ends of the earth, grant us eternal life and keep us free from danger. The Incas built temples to the sun, some of which were plated with gold, and within which were images of the sun god made of pure gold. The people believed in this religion and were pious and peaceful. They gave a part of their time to work for their god and a part for the sick and the widows and orphans. They worked also for the government and last of all for themselves and their families. The Incas irrigated the deserts, and the remains of their aqueducts built of stone slabs neatly fitted together can be seen today. Millions of acres were watered by these works, which included one aqueduct that was 500 miles long. Their irrigating canals ran along the sides of the mountains and also were cut through them in tunnels. As I rode to Cuzco along the high plateau, I saw thousands of acres of terraces, now gone to ruin and almost a desert, that these people once made to blossom like the rose. Such terraces are found on the sides of the mountains above almost every valley of the Peruvian plateau and along the west coast. They extended up the slopes like so many steps, the earth being held back with stone walls. The Incas at that time were by far the most civilized people of all South America, and they are believed by some to have been more advanced than the Aztecs of Mexico. They knew how to mine and work gold and silver, and were skillful in the refining of copper and lead. I have seen some of the tools they used in erecting their buildings. They knew how to temper an alloy of copper and tin in such a way that the tools made of it had an edge like a razor and could cut the hardest of stone. They tamed the wild llamas and alpacas of the pampas. They made the llamas their beasts of burden, and from the wool of the alpaca and the vicuna they wove garments and blankets. They were a nation of potters and shaped beautiful vessels out of clay. They made also hats and shoes and were skilled in the dyeing of fabrics. Here at Cuzco and in other parts of Peru, I have seen animal figures made by the Incas. They are known as the small stone llamas of Cuzco, and are pieces of stone shaped like llamas with a hole in each one the size of a thimble. They were used as sacrifices to Pachamama, the earth, as a payment for the pasture eaten by the flocks. The holes were filled with wine or alcohol, and the images buried in the ground where the sheep and llamas grazed. A new figure was buried each year, the old one being dug up and reinterred at a greater depth. These Incas, whose ancestors date back almost to the time of Christ, knew something of astronomy. They observed the equinoxes and the eclipses of the moon and the sun. They had a system of arithmetic and made calculations by means of knots on strings of different colors. They had musical instruments like some that their descendants play upon today, and it is said that they had songs of lovemaking and a drama. It was while the Inca civilization was at its height that Atahualpa, the ruler of the northern part of their territory, was captured at Cajamarca and put to death by Pizarro. The Spaniards later visited Cuzco and robbed it of its treasures. They tore down the mighty temples and fortresses, erecting churches and other buildings on their foundations, and tried in every way to destroy all vestiges of the Inca Empire. From then until Peru won her independence in the War of 1821, almost three centuries later, Cuzco was in the hands of the Spanish. Ruins of the ancient buildings erected by the Incas are still being found in this valley. In Cuzco itself are the remains of structures of enormous extent. The Temple of the Sun, for instance, which was known to the Incas as the Coricancha, or the Place of Gold, covered the whole square now occupied by the church and convent of Santo Domingo. The old walls of that temple, which in places extend 20 or 30 feet from the ground, form the foundation for the church. I was taken through the buildings by one of the fathers and shown how the great blocks of stone had been fitted together so closely without mortar or cement that the point of a needle could not be pushed into the cracks. The temple was straight on three sides with a great oval at the back. It was about 1,200 feet long, and its walls were two stories high. They were surrounded by a thick cornice or border of gold about 8 inches wide, and where the wall joined the roof there was another broad golden band. The roof was covered with gold, and the inner walls of the temple were plated with it and engraved with designs of vegetables and vines. Opposite the entrance to the temple was a mighty plate of solid gold, heavily encrusted with emeralds and other precious stones, representing a human face surrounded by rays. It was the image of the sun worshipped by the Incas. They considered gold sacred to the sun and often referred to it as the tears of their god. On both sides of the image were the embalmed bodies of the Incas of the past, each seated on a chair of solid gold. Like the fire worshippers of Persia today, the Incas kept burning in the temple a sacred flame that was supposed to never go out. This flame was tended by the virgins of the sun, who had a vast convent not far away. When the Spaniards conquered the Incas, they stripped this temple of all its gold. They melted up the images and vessels used for worship and tore from the walls the golden plates. I am told that there were temples to the sun at many other places in Peru, and also temples to the stars and the moon. According to tradition, there were also chapels to these heavenly bodies in the great temple of Cuzco. Leaving the temple of the sun, I strolled up the narrow street to where the virgins of the sun had their quarters. These young women, in addition to their religious duties, are supposed to have formed a harem for the Incas. They lived in enormous structures scattered over the empire, and some of their convents are said to have had 1,000 members. The one in Cuzco must have covered 8 acres. The walls, which still stand, surround the greater part of a square, forming the foundations of many homes built on the second story. Much of the first story has been turned into stores. The granite walls have been cut away and cave-like vaults made, in which all sorts of industry goes on. I saw a saddler sewing at harness in one cave in the wall, a shoemaker pegging away in a second, and a carpenter sawing and planing in a third. The blocks of this building are of great size, and apparently they will last for ages. Other interesting remains are the walls of the palaces in which the Incas lived. That of Pachacutec stood not far from where the cathedral now is. The original walls of the palace are still preserved to the height of the first story. The remainder of the building was built by the Spaniards and today makes a residence for one of the rich men of Cuzco. One wall of the building is perhaps 300 feet long, including the greater part of the block. The stones are granite of different sizes, beautifully chiseled, and joined with unions so fine that it is impossible to put a knife blade between them. One great block, about 4 feet square and weighing several tons, has 12 angles. I have heard that gold and silver were sometimes placed between the joints as a bedding material, but I saw no evidence of this in my examination. Another legend says that the Incas knew of a plant that, when crushed, softened the stone so that it could be rubbed into the desired shape. Some of the most remarkable buildings of ancient Cuzco were the fortifications of Sacsayhuaman, which crown the top of a hill just back of the city. This hill rises precipitously to a height of 700 or 800 feet above the level of Cuzco. It is so deep that one has to wind about to climb it. I rode upon horseback a part of the way and then left my horse and climbed up the walls of the fort on foot. On the lower slopes of the hill, perhaps 500 feet above Cuzco and facing a garden made in two terraces, stood the palace of Manco Cacapec, the first great Inca ruler. This was directly under the fortifications and commanded a magnificent view of the city and valley. On the first terrace now stands a church, erected in the days of the Inquisition, and outside are some great stone instruments of torture, which were used to bring the Indians and the heretics to the Christian faith. Some of these stones had an opening shaped like a keyhole, the round part of the hole being nearest the ground, and the remainder in the form of a capital T. The hole was just large enough so that a man's head could be squeezed through it, his neck lying on the stone. He was put into this position face downward, and his legs were then bent up over his back and his feet thrust through the T part of the key. The torture was such that it often caused death. I had my secretary get down and put his head through the hole in one of the stones to illustrate how it was done. He refused, however, when I tried to induce him also to let me put his legs through the T. The palace of Manco Cacapec must have been a magnificent home. Its garden covered acres, the main part standing upon a terrace 12 feet above the church I have described. This terrace is made of these wonderful walls into which are fitted sentinel boxes. Walking through the garden, which is now filled with eucalyptus trees and beautiful roses, I came to the ruins of the palace itself. It was made of black granite, the blocks being very thick at the bottom and lessening in size toward the top. On the other side of the structure, some of the stones have been torn away, and I could see that the thick walls were double, filled in with stones and mud. I took a sheet of paper from my notebook and tried to fit it in between the cracks, but found it impossible. Manco Cacapec's palace and its ground are now the property of a wealthy Italian merchant of Cuzco. He has planted the garden with flowers, and the trees that have grown up in it almost hide the city below. Leaving the palace and climbing up to the fort, I found an enormous structure surrounding many acres and enclosing the whole top of the hill. The walls of the fortification are in terraces that rise one over the other. They are made of enormous blocks of granite, some of which weigh many tons. There is no stone of the same nature nearby, and the blocks must have been brought from a great distance. No one knows exactly where they come from, nor how they were carried up this precipitous hill, which is almost 1,000 feet above the plain. It is supposed that roads were made for the purpose and that hundreds of men had to work together to move a single stone. The fort was built long before the time of Columbus, and some of its walls are in perfect condition today. Each section of the wall has a hole for drainage, and the whole structure is almost as smoothly cut as the palaces. I measured some stones that were 15 feet high, and riding on horseback close to the wall, beside one great block, and standing in my stirrups, I was able to reach only halfway up. That stone, I venture, weighed 100 tons. From these fortifications I rode over the hills and plains nearby, which are covered with the remains of other Inca structures. Much of the rock consists of mighty boulders, some as big as a haystack, which were cut into all sorts of shapes. One is known as the Inca throne. The original granite was cut in ledges or steps rising to a low table or bed, upon which the Inca is supposed to have lain on a couch of furs or alpaca skins, with his officials sitting cross-legged on each side of him. Not far from this place is what is called the concert hall or amusement ground of these ancient rulers. It is an open-air court of several acres. On one side of it is a rocky hill in which seats have been cut, and under it is a tunnel supposed to have communicated with the Temple of the Sun in Cuzco, perhaps 3 miles away. This tunnel was closed up after some students at the Cuzco University became lost inside it while hunting for treasures and narrowly escaped death. Another formation near the Inca amusement ground is known as the Rodadero. It consists of granite blocks that look as though they had flowed in ridges down the mountain. The rocks are as smooth as glass, and their slopes are in waves, much like those of a roller coaster. They are grooved and are so formed that one can seat himself at the top in one of the grooves and have a toboggan slide of hundreds of feet rising and falling as he goes down to the bottom. It is the greatest shoot-the-chute I have ever seen, and if it could be lifted from the top of the Andes to Coney Island, it would surely make a fortune of the man who owned it. About 60 miles northwest of Cuzco are the ruins of Machu Picchu, which were discovered in 1911 by Professor Hiram Bingham of Yale University, and which are said to be more wonderful than those of Cuzco. It is believed that those ruins mark the site of the lost city of Tampu Toca. One legend says that the city, and not an island on Lake Titicaca, was the place from which the Incas came when they went out upon the plateau and founded their vast empire. Machu Picchu is situated on a mountaintop in one of the most inaccessible parts of the Andes, and was evidently deserted by the Incas when they made Cuzco their capital. There is no record of its ever having been discovered by the Spaniards, which accounts for the remarkable state of preservation of its temples and fortifications. Other Inca ruins near Cuzco have been found at Ollantaytambo and at Vitcos. The latter place was probably the last stronghold of an Inca monarch. When Pizarro captured Cuzco, he appointed the son of a former king as a figurehead ruler. This Inca rebelled against Spanish domination, and gathering together an army of loyal Indians, he attacked Cuzco. His siege was unsuccessful, and so he retreated to the mountains with his followers. He lived at Vitcos for 10 years, and at his death, his two sons governed this last remaining vestige of the Inca Empire for 35 years longer. End of chapter 17.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.